I'd like to welcome you and thank you for responding to our invitation to attend today. Freethinkers at UU Sarasota invite you to a free exchange of ideas about religion, morality, ethics, and justice. Rabbi Shalom is the Dean for North America of the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism and Rabbi of Kol Hadash Humanistic Congregation in suburban Chicago. So at this point, Rabbi Adam Shalom. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to escape Chicago for warmer climates. And this is warmer than it is in Chicago, even if it's cold for you. 15 years ago, I was very, very busy. I was in a master's degree program at the University of Michigan. I was teaching at a humanistic synagogue in suburban Detroit. I was working as a graduate student assistant. So I was taking classes, teaching kids, teaching college students. It was a very busy time for me. And then my father got sick. And my father is not someone who generally gets sick. He came down with what we found out later was diverticulitis, which is an inflammation of the lower intestine. Very painful, but treatable. We didn't know at the time what it was. He was simply in the hospital in a tremendous amount of pain. And so one day, in between teaching here and teaching there and taking classes and writing and doing everything else that I was doing, I drove from Ann Arbor to the hospital he was in Southfield, which is a little bit east, maybe an hour east of Ann Arbor. It was a gray and cloudy day, and I was obviously very stressed dealing with what was going on. As I was driving over a hill, about 15 minutes from the hospital, all of a sudden, across the sky, I saw the largest rainbow I had ever seen. It was thick. It was bright. It was beautiful. Now, I didn't imagine that the cosmos had arranged things so that I would see that rainbow. But I knew that that moment was meaningful. Even in the midst of my stress, my anxiety, I was able to focus, pay attention, be open to seeing beauty in the world around me. And of course, I wasn't the only person who was able to see that rainbow. But I don't know if everyone else in their cars looked out the window to see it, or if it was as meaningful to them as it was to me at that moment. 2,000 years ago, one rabbi said, if a person is walking on his way and is studying rabbinic law, and he interrupts his study to say, how beautiful is this tree? How pleasant is this newly plowed field? It is as if he had sinned against his own soul. This is a traditionalist religious perspective, that nature is not the source of meaning. The only source of meaning is the religious tradition and its authority. That's what's acceptable. But today, I might say, and I'm a very different kind of rabbi from that rabbi 2,000 years ago, if a person is walking on his or her way, and they say, how pleasant is this tree, or how beautiful is this field, and then they interrupt their contemplation to imagine how much more profitable it would be to build a strip mall on this field, it is as if they had sinned against their own soul. The question of a secular spirituality is a very intense debate in free-thinking circles, secular, humanist, whatever label you choose. In fact, I saw that Sam Harris of The End of Religion and The End of Faith, rather, and many harsh critiques of religion is writing a book on a non-theistic spirituality. I can't wait to see the letters that he gets out of that experience. From the people who followed him because of his critique of religion, now, all of a sudden, they might think, he's changed sides. He's talking spiritualism. What is he doing? When we think about the concept of spirituality as it may apply to a secular thinker then, we have to understand it's less an etymological debate over what does the word spirituality really mean in its origins, and more of a phenomenological discussion. What are the experiences that people describe as spiritual? And do we have experiences that might be candidates for a kind of natural spirituality? So let me give you a few examples, short, that were experiences of mine that were natural spirituality. The first was watching the Discovery Channel, programs on primates. Whenever you watch documentary films about primates, and you see them grooming each other, and you see them caring for their young, using tools, playing, part of you thinks, it's amazing how human they are. But the truth is, they are us. We share a huge proportion of our DNA with them. We share a common evolutionary ancestor. They are, in many ways, distant cousins. And that's a feeling of being part of something larger than yourself. It can be very emotional, even, if you see them mourning a dead child. A second example of a natural spirituality is when you look at old family photographs. My father has pictures of his family when they were still living in Syria before they came to New York in 1915 or so. And you can see his mother there, and you can see many members of the family, and it's amazing to me how many of his great-great-grandparents look like him. His ears, his forehead. And you see that in those family pictures. You see how life continues. It's always amazing to me that we never figured out genetics before. I remember when I was in college and you would have parents visiting day, and you would see both parents of someone you knew very well, and all of a sudden you saw where they got it. Oh, you take part of this and part of that, and you put it together, and there it is. Well, it's even more the case when you look back at old, old, old family pictures. That can be an experience of a sense of roots, but also a sense of, again, being part of something larger, longer, deeper than yourself. And the last example was, again, an experience I had. This is closer to 20 years ago now. I was in Israel for the first time, and I went to visit the Western Wall in Jerusalem, which is the last retaining wall that remains standing from the Jerusalem Temple that was destroyed around the year 70 of the Common Era, so almost 2,000 years ago. And I knew a lot about this site from my historical study. I was getting a bachelor's in Jewish studies. I had read about archaeology on my own. I knew that that wall wasn't part of the original temple wall. It was built by King Herod just before it was destroyed, in fact. So it wasn't 2,500 years old. It was only 2,000 years old, no matter what the PR brochure said that you got walking into the plaza. And I knew that that big, beautiful plaza that was there didn't used to be there. In fact, before 1967, there was a whole neighborhood there. And there were people living in that neighborhood. It was called the Fifth Quarter of Jerusalem. It was the Mughrabi Quarter, the North African Quarter. But after 1967, when Israel conquered the West Bank and East Jerusalem, they cleared the plaza because they knew there'd be lots of people coming who would want to visit. But if you look at pictures of the site in the 1920s, the 1930s, it's an alley with houses there. So there were houses there. I knew that. I also knew that this was not an uncontested site. There were people just above me on the top of that mountain who were attending something called the Dome of the Rock, which is, of course, one of the three holiest shrines in Muslim practice. And they also had a claim to this space. And I knew walking into this space that it was a gender-segregated space, women to one side, men to the other. And now it's become even more segregated since I went there. When I went there, you could walk up to a certain point together, and then you had to split and go to the wall. Now, even entering the plaza, there's a gender segregation. And I knew that I had to wear a silly paper yarmulke on my head to be able to go to the wall, because the guardians of the wall would not let you do it without it. And I was annoyed that I had not brought my baseball cap, because that would have been acceptable, as long as my head was covered. I knew all of these reasons to be disconnected from this place. And yet when I got to the front, and I touched the stones, and I felt how smooth they were, and I realized they were smooth because of all the generations of my family, my ancestors, my people who had come and touched these stones with their hopes and their longing and their despair. It was an electric moment for me, and it was not because I had touched God or touched the holy site or contacted another plane of existence. It was meaningful to me because of what I knew about that place and the people who had been there, and the connection I had to them. That was a spiritual moment for me because it inspired me. It uplifted my spirits. Now, each of you have had experiences like this, whatever you call it. Abraham Maslow, the humanistic psychologist, called them peak experiences. Others call them meaningful experiences, experiences of meaning. Some might call them spiritual experiences, but you've all had it. When you ask people to think of these things, they might say the birth of a child, the death of a parent, a beautiful sunrise in a place they'd never been. There are plenty of opportunities for this. We all have one of them. Now, the challenge is that this word spirituality, as I said, has some baggage with it. And it's a relatively new word. You didn't have farmers living in the Middle Ages worrying about their spiritual experiences. It's happened in the modern world because there's been a disconnect with the life of tradition. Now, for many people, this is why the secular world is somewhat skeptical, that might think that secular spirituality is an oxymoron. But for the religious world, spirituality is a meaningful concept for them in a supernatural sense. It's connecting your spirit or your soul to the supernatural world, the spirit world. It could be to a god, it could be to angels, it could be to auras, it could be to a world soul, any number of vocabulary pieces for that. Now, it used to be the case that the way one found one's spirituality was exclusively through traditional religion, prayer service, ritual practice, individual contemplation and meditation. And for some, it is still the case that that's where they find their spiritual needs. They have their spiritual experiences through the channel of traditional religion. But there are also people out there who would describe themselves today as spiritual but not religious. I don't know of anyone, by the way, that describes themselves as religious but not spiritual. Because if they would describe themselves as religious, the assumption is they're getting that spiritual peace through their institutional religion. But someone who is spiritual but not religious, what does that mean? It means someone who's open to these kind of experiences but doesn't like institutional structures, doesn't like organized religion. I occasionally get people who call my congregation and say, I sort of like what you stand for with this cultural Jewish identity and humanistic philosophy, but I don't like organized religion. And my response to them is, well, we're not that organized. I think disorganized religion would be a good bumper sticker. They don't like the structures. They don't like being told to think this or say this or feel this at certain times and places. They want to be able to experience it on their own. They're freelance spiritualists. Now, why so much focus on this word now? And why doesn't traditional religion meet the needs of these spiritual but not religious seekers? I think there are a number of factors, but two most important. The first is the emergence of something new in the last few hundred years. We don't think of it as new because it predated us, so then it's old. But in a historical sense, it's relatively new. It's called the individual. Now, why is the individual new? Well, before, you were identified by collective identities, your clan, your tribe, your professional guild, your city of residence, your nation of residence, which even then was a big abstraction. It was too big. You were more allied, think of the Civil War, you were allied to your state more than to the nation. Think of Robert E. Lee, who hated slavery, who hated secession, but who couldn't fight Virginia. That was his first love. Well, that was life. You were part of a collective identity. But now what we experience today is individualism, sometimes individualism to the extreme, to our own chagrin. But it's individualism. People are mobile geographically. They're able to travel the world and live in any part of the world. My guess is many of the people in this room did not grow up in Sarasota, Bradenton. My guess is that your kids don't live in the town where they grew up in many cases. Some do, but many have moved. I remember a scientific exploration that proved this point in a dramatic way. They found a man in England who was maybe 8,000 years old. They found this old, old skeleton. And they decided for comparison to test the DNA of people in the surrounding village. And it turns out they found a direct male line descendant of that 8,000-year-old skeleton. So you can imagine the school teacher, and was a school teacher, has this family tree with one person and then a lot of space and then the rest of what he knows. But it also shows you how little they moved. To think that someone in your family has been living in this area for 8,000 years. But most peoples have not moved as much as they move today. It's a radical change, and that facilitates the exploration of the individual. And an individual wants to know, what is the experience for me? Not what are you telling me to do, but how do I experience these things? The same is true with economic mobility. Not only mobility up and down in the socioeconomic standing, but choosing your profession. This is not, you're a farmer, your kids are farmers, your grandkids are farmers. You're a blacksmith, your kids are blacksmiths. It doesn't work that way anymore. Along with this geographic mobility and this economic mobility comes ideological mobility. Maybe you don't have to believe everything your parents or your religious authority figures or your political authority figures tell you to believe. You have the right to speak your own mind. Well, why would that change once you enter a religious institution? If you have political authority and importance and a voice out there, should you not have a spiritually important, a religiously important, a cosmically important even voice inside this institution? Now, the downside to individualism also facilitates a quest for spirituality. It's loneliness. I'm standing on my own. I'm all on my... Where is everybody else? Where are my friends? Where's my family? Well, we do find that dynamic of loneliness. There are people who object to pedestrians who talk on their cell phones. Now, they're at their own risk, right? If they're going to walk into a pole, it's their problem. But I never object to pedestrians talking on their cell phone because it's a quest to overcome loneliness. They don't have to be alone. Even in a city of 10 million people walking down the street where they don't know anybody around them, they can be talking to someone they know, they care about, they have a connection with. It's overcoming this loneliness. And so that quest for this meaningful experience, that feeling part of something larger than yourself, that connection to your family's ancestral past, or the global reach of natural life, carbon-based life that we experience, that's, again, trying to overcome that experience of individualism to the extreme. And finally, the most important reason why people would say they are spiritual and not religious when it comes to the individual is that you get to change your identification. I'm curious how many people who are members of this Unitarian Church were raised as Unitarians. My guess is it's a minority. Just as in a humanistic Jewish congregation, most of the members were not raised in a humanistic Jewish identity. They are movements of immigrants, institutions of people leaving one identity and choosing to be someone else. It's not unusual today to have someone say, I was raised this, but now I'm that. It's the marketplace of ideas. There's no reason you have to stay what you were. You can be what you choose to be. And in that kind of a situation, in that kind of a setting, people are going to seek meaningful experience in their own way, on their own terms, spiritual but not religious. Now, the second development that I think has accelerated this quest for inquiry about, curiosity with, or even animosity towards spirituality as a term, are the new discoveries in human knowledge that have taken place over the last few centuries. Our understanding of history, particularly religious history, believing that, in fact, the evidence does not suggest that human beings began 6,000 years ago with an Adam and Eve, or that there was a global flood, or that there was a patriarch named Abraham who had children that led to the Jewish people, or that there was an exodus from Egypt in all the details described in the book of Exodus. The evidence simply doesn't suggest that that was true. And if you begin to question those beliefs, those claims of fact, then maybe other questions are open to reinterpretation. A second new force of knowledge is science, which helps to explain the world in great detail. We don't wonder what the rainbow is anymore. We don't even wonder whether it's a memento of Noah's flood. After all, Noah's flood is an origin story, an ideology for the rainbow. But we don't need that to explain why it's there anymore. We have refracting light. Get a prism and you'll see how the rainbow is developed. We have advances in philosophy that have found ways to find meaning and meaningful life and meaningful community organization independent of revealed religion. We have ethics and values that don't depend on a commander telling you what to do. You know, the traditional model of ethics is do what I say so because I say so. I am the great and powerful Oz. That is why you follow the rules. And just in case you don't believe the authority, you should know that he knows if you've been sleeping. He knows if you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good. Well, we don't believe in that system anymore, and in fact, ethics has evolved to the point that we don't need an authority figure telling us what to do to be able to live good and meaningful lives. And most importantly, we've learned that our way of doing things is not the only way to do things. The more you explore other cultures in the world, their sense of knowledge, human experience, beauty, truth, the more you realize that your version is constructed just as their version is constructed. I was on a radio program yesterday on Sarasota Public Radio, and actually the interview is online on their site. You can find it. And one of the callers who called in said, well, how do you handle people who say they have mystical experiences? What do you do with that? You just psychoanalyze it? And say they you know they had a blot of mustard or they you know had a problematic episode, as we say today, a brain episode. I said, well, the challenge is that all of these mystics that have experience tend to see what they expect to see. That is, Jewish mystics meet Moses, and Christian mystics meet Jesus, and Muslim mystics meet Muhammad. You don't get a lot of Christian mystics who meet Muhammad. In other words, what that means is they are having an experience, and then they are interpreting that experience in ways that agree with their pre-existing beliefs. And that's true for us as well. The more we study world culture, we see a variety of these experiences, ways to pursue this experience, this spiritual, meaningful experience. But they don't all fit in our categories of thought. There isn't a strong Jewish tradition of calm, quiet meditation. You think about if you had experience with Jewish family members or yourself were raised Jewish, there's much more of a tradition of loud, angry argument than quiet, calm meditation. But in other cultures, quiet and calm meditation is a deep part of what they do and how they live. So we've learned from the other cultures in the world. Now the challenge is, and this was the romantic reaction in the 19th century to the Enlightenment, which claimed to represent science and reason. The romantic reaction was, what about the romance? What about the emotion? What about uplifting the human spirit if it's all science and fact? And so the first poem on your handout is an excerpt from a poem called Lamia by John Keats that asks the core question. Do not all charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy? There was an awful rainbow once in heaven. We know her woof, her texture. She is given in the dull catalog of common things. Philosophy will clip an angel's wings, conquer all mysteries by rule and line, empty the haunted air and gnomed mine, unweave a rainbow. Is there beauty if it's all about facts and science and how it came to be? Can you have wonder, awe, inspiration if your goal is simply to analyze and to catalog? We take the rainbow and add it, as Keats says, to the dull catalog of common things. We take the mind that we imagined was full of gnomes and we investigate with a flashlight. And there are no gnomes there anymore. You may have seen a movie a couple of years ago called The Invention of Lying with Ricky Gervais. It's a very interesting movie. Makes a good humanist movie night. Because in this conceit of this movie, The Invention of Lying, no one in humanity has evolved the ability to lie. Everyone always tells the truth and the facts. And it's a tremendously boring world because there are no movies other than documentaries, which are historical. and they are composed of a person sitting there reading the script. That's the movie, because you can't have an actor pretending to be someone else. He'd be lying. Of course, there's also no religion in that world of no lying. But the challenge is there's no creativity, there's no beauty, there's no art, because you have to be willing to not analyze everything to have space in your experience for those pieces. Well, this is where we enter a natural spirituality, finding a way to have our rationality and our inspiration too. We want to uplift the human spirit. After all, the word spirituality finds its root in respiration. It's breathing. It's uplifting, feeling higher than yourself, not in a supernatural plane, but in the sense when you take a deep breath and you feel full of oxygen and life. That's inspiration. It responds to the needs of this new individual, but it's also responsive to new discoveries and knowledge. So I want to share with you a second poem on the right side. It's called In the Beginning by Primo Levi, himself a Holocaust survivor and a chemist and scientist, who finds a way to make the Big Bang humanly inspiring. Fellow humans, to whom a year is a long time, a century a venerable goal, struggling for your bread, tired, fretful, tricked, sick, lost, listen, and may it be mockery and consolation. 20 billion years before now, brilliant, soaring in space and time, there was a ball of flame, solitary, eternal, our common father and our executioner. It exploded, and every change began. Even now, the thin echo of this one reverse catastrophe resounds from the farthest reaches. From that one spasm, everything was born. The same abyss that enfolds and challenges us, the same time that spawns and defeats us. Everything anyone has ever thought, the eyes of every woman we have loved, sons by the thousands, and this hand that writes. I love it, because it's the cosmic scale and the human scale. It's connecting us to every part of the universe. He's not claiming that this happened expressly for him to be able to write this poem, but when he thinks back to the chain of events that led to him writing this poem, he is struck with a sense of awe, wonder, transcendence, meaning. You don't have to be scientific all the time. You see, people fear that the spiritual experience is anti-rational. It's saying, I don't believe in science, I don't believe in reason, this is a better way to find the truth, this is the only way to find the truth, is my personal emotional experience. That's not what you're saying at all with a natural spirituality. There are times to be rational and analyze, and there are times to be what I would call non-rational. That is, don't analyze, but experience. I once went to a jazz music concert when I was in college, and a friend of mine was a jazz musician. And he was appreciating all the themes coming back and how the measures were 5/8 instead of 4/4, and he could appreciate the technical side of the music. I didn't have enough musical training to do that, but I appreciated the beauty of the experience of feeling the music. You don't have to look for patterns in the clouds to enjoy lying on your back on a sunny day and seeing the clouds. There's a wonderful chapter in a book called Living Without God by Ron Aronson, who's a retired professor at Wayne State University. He describes an experience of gratitude that he had, and he's as atheist as you get. He's even a Marxist atheist, which is even more atheist than atheist. He took a walk one day in a state park in Michigan where he lives, and he had a long hike. It was very hot over hills and through the forest, and then he came to a beautiful, secluded lake, and the birds were landing. It was just a gorgeous experience, and he felt welling up inside of himself this feeling that could only be described as gratitude. He wasn't directing his gratitude up and above or to the Big Bang that led to the chain of events that could be here. He could have directed his gratitude to the Michigan Department of Environment that maintained the trails that he took to get to this park, or the taxpayers who paid for the park to be able to, for him to enjoy it. He could have mapped it out if he wanted to, but the point for him was the feeling, the experience of gratitude that he found at that moment. And we can say, I feel lucky. I want to say thank you to existence. Thank you that I'm alive. Thank who? Thank goodness. We can express that feeling of gratitude. It's not an anti-rational way, but it's not something that needs to be analyzed into the chemical composition of your brain at that moment. Well, what are some of the characteristics of this experience of meaning? Again, I'm analyzing what I said not to analyze, but that's okay. Often these experiences are unexpected. Or even if it's something like the birth of a child or a death of a parent, it's been coming, you know it's coming, but still, it catches you by surprise. It takes you out of your normal analytic, rational mode. A second characteristic is you have to be open to it. If I had been focused on the speedometer and not looking up, I would not have seen that rainbow. I would have missed it. You have to have something in you that's open to finding these experiences. The third is that it's often out of the ordinary. It's not something that happens every day. You know, your morning Starbucks is not going to do it for you. I know for some people it's a religious experience to get their Starbucks in the morning. But for most people, it does not have a transcendent quality to it because it's routine, it's mundane. It's when you go to a new place or see something old in a new way, the first time the blue heron lands on your lake that you've never seen there before. That experience, out of the ordinary, unexpected, is what you remember. And you remember it in a deep way. Often these meaningful experiences are what we call a snapshot memory. I know where I was when this happened. I know what was happening when that happened, when I had that experience. It sticks in your brain. It's frozen in time and incredibly vivid. Often these experiences of meaning are in silence. At least your silence. Maybe it's appreciating music and there's noise. Or you're in an art gallery and there's noise around you. But you're quiet. It may not be anything you're saying or doing. It's something you're experiencing. Often these meaningful experiences have what I call a natural transcendence. You're not focused on yourself. When you're in the midst of hearing a beautiful, beautiful aria, or contemplating a work of art that transcends you, or experiencing nature in a way you've never experienced it before, you're not thinking about yourself. You're experiencing the moment. You get beyond yourself. Again, not in a supernatural way, but in a non-rational, non-analytic way. And finally, most of these experiences are accompanied with a kind of emotional uplift. Your spirits feel raised, not from the dead, but rather uplifted, inspired, higher in a sense of more active, more vibrant. That's the kind of experience that we seek. Now, you might say, I don't need that. I'm perfectly happy reading my Scientific American every week, or month, I guess it's a month. Well, why are these experiences important? Why do secular and humanistic and free-thinking people need to cultivate them and need to find a way to answer this need? It's a basic human need. It's not an accident that every culture in human experience has sought these kind of experiences. We need to respond to the deep human needs that religion itself evolved to meet. You know, this is the irony. If you're involved in any organizational politics in the secular, atheist, and humanist world, you'd think they'd be rational. The problem is, they're still human. That is, human beings can be rational and can be emotional. That's who we are. We are both. We are not one or the other. We are not better one and worse at the other. These emotional needs are human too. We need to find ways to feel gratitude. We need to find ways to feel part of our roots and an ancient past. We need to find ways to feel part of the future and connected to life that will live beyond us, even if it isn't our individual consciousness. We need a sense of future. So we have to find a way to meet that need in the vocabulary, and the categories that make sense to us. A second reason why these experiences are important is that they break down that artificial barrier that we've created between the heart and mind. We like to think, well, one person's emotional and one person's rational, and that's how it works. Or I'm thinking with my heart and not with my head. Well, I hate to break it to you, but all of your thinking is in your head because the heart pumps blood, it doesn't think. That's the rational way of thinking. But the other way to remember is that our emotions affect our reason too. We are not abstract calculating machines. If you're in a bad mood, you're going to be thinking differently than if you're in a good mood. You can read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, on how we make decisions, and he points out that most of our decisions are rationalizations. We make the decision in the first few seconds, and then we come up with lots of reasons to explain the decision we already made. It's not reasoning, it's rationalization. And that also has wonderful powerful implications for trying to convince someone of something else. Because you can offer all the rational reasons you want, but if it doesn't speak to them emotionally, they may not agree with you. Well, so we need to find ways to break down that barrier and explore the fact that we are both emotional and reasonable at the same time, always. A third reason why we need these moments is that they stop the unstoppable rush of time. They allow us to savor a moment. It's been 15 years since that rainbow, but if I think back to that moment, I can see it. It's been almost 20 years since that first touch of the Western Wall, and I've been back since, but I can still feel that smooth stone. And by the way, I did not leave a slip of paper with a request in the wall. I didn't need that. But that feel of the stone is there. You can be brought back to smells of your childhood, to sights of the first time you saw that grandchild. There are those moments that stop time and help you go back in time to experience them over again. In a deep sense, these experiences of meaning make us happy, make us feel like life is rich and valuable and varied and beautiful, and that's important. Individual happiness is a worthy goal. I want to give you one other example of how that moment can get crystallized into poetry. It's on the left side under Lamia by John Keats, a poem called The Power of Accident by Lawrence Levine. Now, Lawrence Levine himself was a professor of biology. He was a scientist. But he also could find a moment that struck him and create beauty out of it. You can tell the moment from the poem. He simply opened a book and found a pair of flower petals in the book. But look what he does with this poem. Someone laid the petals in the big dictionary again. We always do that, placing such things in heavy books, wishing to hold what we know will inevitably pass. But have you noticed how perfectly they were located, pressed there between metalwork and meter, directly under metaphor? Surely that is what they are now. Their luminous bodies and lustrous flesh have gone where the summers go, and only the veins remain as a testament to the sweet sap that ran with the solstice. But I will bet that it was just chance that defined those petals so well. Chance can set things right. I mean, look at us, what we are, how we met in the deep waters between metalwork and meter, and then see how we have come to cleave together, tighter than the weave woven of the shadows in the woods, thicker than the juices that run through all the golden veins of summer. Beautiful moment, a statement of love. Again, attentive to the moment, but seeing the bigger picture and bringing it to us, the reader, to experience along with him. Now, where can we find these experiences? Plenty of places. You can find it in nature, more so in Sarasota than in Chicago at the moment. But when you take a walk, don't think about how much longer do I have and what time is the show on. Experience the sounds, the smells, the sights, if you're comfortable, the touches. Remember, leaves of three, let it be. It can be in your backyard on a starry night. It can be out on a boat with a clear sky. It can be feeling connected to the natural world, even in an intellectual way. One of my favorite stops in New York City is the Museum of Natural History and their exhibit on evolution, because that makes me feel connected. I remember once seeing a picture of the cave paintings in Lascaux, which date back to 20,000 years before now. And they have bison, and they have hunts, and all kinds of imagery. But my favorite picture of all is where a person put their hand on the wall and took some paint in a tube and went and blew the outline of their hand on the wall, as if to say, I was here. I love that painting. And they've even begun to study that painting to see if they can tell something about the person who made it by the size of the hand and the shape of the knuckles, and what can they find out? But even more important than what they can learn is that experience of seeing that past, our cultural evolution beginning in a new direction. And the other experience you can have to connect to nature in a meaningful way is to participate in nature. Plant something and grow it. Enjoy the seasons, all seasons, even the cold seasons. There's a member of my congregation in Chicago who is a dog walker. And she knows when spring is coming, and she knows when winter is coming, because she's out there every single day, not in her car on the way to the office and back. She's experiencing nature in a deep way. But don't assume that you don't get to experience nature in a participatory way, too. There's an old story that makes the point very clearly. A man has planted a beautiful garden in his backyard, and he invites his neighbor over to take the tour. And his neighbor says to him, "What a marvelous garden you and God have created." And the man says, "You should have seen it when God had it to himself." We are part of nature, and we can participate in nature. A second example is, in the examples I gave, of history. Experience a kind of temporal transcendence. Why is Ancestry.com and genealogy so attractive and so interesting and so fascinating? Why do people want heirlooms? Who needs a samovar from 1905? There are much better ways to make tea these days. But it belonged to people you loved. It was part of their experience. You feel a sense of being part of something by connecting to that heirloom, to that past, to finding out where your family roots came from. People do genetic tests to find out things they didn't know about their past, to feel connected to their real roots. You can find inspiration from literature, both modern and traditional literature. In the Bible, in the very first chapter of Genesis, which is not fact, there's a wonderful statement of truth. It is not good for humanity to be alone. It's true. That is a statement of human wisdom. The Noah story is an expression of human experience. It's ethically terrible. After all, if you make a mistake or things go wrong, do you kill everything and everybody? What did those other cows do wrong that they all had to die? What did those babies do wrong that they all had to die? Ethically, it's problematic. But have you ever worked on a project and you get to a point that you're so frustrated that all you want to do is take it and tear it up and throw it away? Of course, we've all had that experience. But if you see God as the character in the story, who's expressing human needs, desires, frustrations, impulses, now you can understand it as a literary exploration of the human condition. And there again, we can find that inspiration. And I gave you in your handout other examples of this kind of transcended personal experience. The poem Grateful by Bernard Green explores the question of why do I feel grateful, and on the back, a poem by Yehuda Amichai called The Jews is, again, a Jewish example of this transcendence through human connection, but also through literature. You'll see allusions to the Bible and other passages that speak to his sense of roots. We can find a sense of inspiration from ethics, from doing good deeds. The story about the man who jumps on the subway tracks to save someone's life. Not because he knows them or loves them, but because they're a person. We call deeds that are wonderfully ethical beautiful in an aesthetic sense, right? We're inspired by them, and we are inspired to do them. You can feel that sense of transcendence helping someone learn to read or providing sustenance to someone who is tremendously hungry. Political activism can do that for some people. Abraham Joshua Heschel, the rabbi from Eastern Europe, said that when he marched with Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma, my feet were praying. For him, the marching, the activism, the public stand was a meaningful experience. And we can also find that sense of spiritual ethics when we empower ourselves and empower other people. This is a passage from a book that our institute has published called Secular Spirituality. Really an excellent read. Speaking of the need for ethics, we need to develop the ethical side of our spirituality. Transcendent experiences that focus only on nature and the universe to the exclusion of other people are morally dangerous. A healthy spirituality is not so transcendent that human affairs become unimportant. Some of the most significant moments of empowerment come from working together with others to alleviate suffering and to strengthen the community. We need to cultivate the internal spirituality that courage brings. In a world where guaranteed happy endings are illusions and magic power is the stuff of fantasy, the ultimate spiritual experience is not the surrender to God. It is the sense of empowerment that refuses to surrender to adversity and insists that taking risks is as sublime as naive faith. Not only for us, but for others as well. Obviously, we find these experiences in personal connections. The wonder of love, the power of children and parents, the passage of time and its defeat by memory. One of the tragedies when a couple that has been together for 50 years or 60 years loses one of the partners is that the living partner could say to themselves, that's the last person who remembered me when I was young, who knew me when I was who I came to be as an adult for the first time. Human memory is stronger than time. But also, it's not only family, it's friends, it's community. It's the family you choose for yourself. And finally, we can find this spiritual experience, this uplifting moment, in beauty, through art and through music. It's nonverbal often, but it's wonderfully meaningful. And one more passage from the book. It may be objected that natural spirituality diminishes the importance of values, aesthetic and moral, inasmuch as they are merely human values. How much more significant they would be if underwritten by supernatural authority. On the contrary, natural spirituality may inspire us to appreciate beauty, as well as justice, honesty, love, and so forth, all the more because we are aware that human beings are entirely responsible for creating and promoting values, as well as the conditions that make them possible. Absent the belief in a creator God, we may be more appreciative of a neighbor's garden because we are aware of the human intelligence and creativity, not to mention labor, that transformed randomly scattered seeds into an intelligently designed place of beauty. Whatever we behold in the natural world of flowers, mountains, and oceans, and in the human world of poetry, buildings, and morality, we who locate our spirituality entirely within the human mind may be all the more appreciative of that mind's power. Aware that beauty enriches our lives, evokes the most powerful emotions, and inspires the noblest ambitions, aware that is that beauty causes the spirit to soar, we naturally wish to cultivate beauty and the appreciation of beauty in our lives and families and communities. It is clear that absent belief in God, you are nevertheless a spiritual person. Unless you have no use for music, literature, drama, or dance, unless you are oblivious to the genius of Shakespeare and Chopin and the talent of Michael Jordan, unless you are indifferent to the majesty of a mountain range or the spectacle of a starry sky, it is clear that your spirituality derives entirely from within you. It is clear that each of us imposes our notions of beauty upon mountains and men. That is our greatness. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this exploration of a secular spirituality. I hope in the end you've decided it is more emotional meaning than oxymoron. But most importantly, I hope that you've found these categories of thought will inspire you to seek these experiences and to find out the experiences of others in our quest for a deeper and more meaningful human experience of ourselves.
We have some time for questions now, and this is the way we're going to handle that. We have two mics. Deanna has one, and I have one. She's going to go to the first person who raises their hand and wants to talk, and I'll try to get the second. So we'll be milling around getting our exercise as well as giving you a chance to speak. So do we have someone who would like to start with a question?
Criticisms or comments are welcome, too.
Got one over here.
Hi, apologies. I came in very late, but I do have, you might have already covered this. I'm an atheist, recovering Catholic, and I've noticed in the humanist literature, in the atheist literature, there's a great grump. Are you getting much pushback on the use of the word spirituality? Or was that your whole talk?
It's what I started with. But in a nutshell, yes, absolutely. And actually, I mentioned that Sam Harris, who's one of the very strong and assertive atheist writers, is writing a book on spirituality, and he's going to get a lot of grief for doing that. But he's into meditation. He's into personal exploration. And so that's part of what he does. He's a neuroscientist, and he likes the idea of calming the brain. There is a pushback from those who are concerned that spirituality is uniquely or unredeemably supernatural. My approach is that because this is a human need, we need to find a humanist way or a secular way to respond to that need. And if we use the word spirituality or not, we shouldn't be allergic to it. Now, if I got up in my congregation and I said, spiritual, 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 they might get nervous. Just like if I defined holy as meaning special, set apart, very important, I might get away with it once in a while. But if I said holy, 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 again, they would begin to feel that this isn't what they came for. There's only so far a word can go in a creative use of the meaning. So I think when it comes to the word spirituality, again, I don't use it unexplained. I try to explain what I mean when I'm using it. But I also try to use that technique of explaining, here's what the experience is. You've had an experience like this, whether you call it something else. If we can agree that it's potato, potato, instead of heresy or not, then I think we've made progress.
There was an interesting article in this morning's paper. Did you happen to see it? On the new subspecialty being offered by the USF Health Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurosciences, and it's being sponsored by the Samaritan Counseling Services, the Gulf Coast, and it's to offer a subspecialty on how faith interacts with traditional mental health services. And I think that's a rather interesting, and it all goes on to say, baseline training in different faith systems and how religion shapes perspective and strategies in discussing belief systems in psychological counseling.
I think it's actually a smart idea, because there are people out there who live in the religious world who themselves are religious who may need mental health services, counseling, therapy, even more direct intervention. If you don't understand their framework, their standpoint approaching these questions, then you're not going to be an effective counselor or treatment person. If you assume it's purely delusion and infantile fantasy, then you're not going to treat them as a rational adult person who can be in charge of their own treatment. So I think it's a good advance so that therapists working with people will be most effective in dealing with their issues without getting into the question of, is their religion true or not? That's not always as relevant to solving the particular issue.
Why are so many people who are allegedly comfortable with their religion so against people who don't accept that religion? That could be atheists. It could be people who believe and other ways of worshiping God. Why do people who are comfortable being heterosexual feel so threatened by homosexuals? What is it about that? What if you know something about that, I'd love to hear it.
Well, it's an interesting challenge. I got into a debate recently. There was an article published on a Jewish magazine, an interview with David Silverman, who's the head of American Atheists, whom you can see on Fox News periodically, yelling at somebody else. And what was interesting about the interview with David Silverman, by his name you can guess he comes from a Jewish background, but he himself says, I'm not Jewish. And if you don't accept the Bible and the Talmud and all of Jewish tradition, you're not Jewish either. And I laughed because he's saying that the Orthodox are the only true Jews, which is what the Orthodox say. And so there are some dogmatic atheists who say, well, you can't be a liberal Christian. That's ridiculous. You have to believe the Bible is absolutely true. Well, that's what the fundamentalists say. Why should the atheists agree with the fundamentalists that the only way to do it is the traditional way? I think one of the reasons why people, I mean, there's a lot of reasons you can guess why people might be threatened by someone doing it differently. One is maybe they have secret doubts themselves. That's always a possibility. The second is that it doesn't fit in their framework of what is possible. If you believe that the only source of ethics is a divinely revealed set of laws, because you can't rely on people to make up their own mind, it'll lead to anarchy and disaster, and someone goes around saying, you don't need a God to tell you how to be good, you can do it for yourself, that to them is threatening to how they think society works. They see that as dangerous. And so they're reacting to a framework that doesn't fit in their conception of what is good or even conceivable, to be good and secular. So that there's a sense of threatenedness. And the same is true with marriage and marriage equality and so on. I think the biggest challenge, however, is that it's different. It's new. It's not what I'm used to. There are plenty of secular people, by the way, who have that same reaction to a new iPad, or an iPhone, or they change the recipe of the soup at the restaurant I go to, and how dare they? I try to make the point to people that secular thinkers can't say, well, this is the way we've always done it, because we've changed everything else. We have to be flexible. But all too often, human beings fall into patterns of what they're used to and what they know, and that is what is good. We have to learn that sometimes good can be different, and different can be good. So that's the biggest reason I think people react negatively, is it's just different and foreign to them. They've never experienced it before, and how can it be good if it's different? That's the fear.
A lot of I found that my daughter's a Baptist, and my father was an atheist, and I was raised Unitarian. And over the time, it seems like the word humility, if people could truly practice humility and understand that they don't really know everything. Scientists don't know everything yet, or whether they ever will. Atheists don't. My daughter, the Baptist, doesn't. And humility is really the word here to me.
It's a very interesting way to frame it, that we have limited knowledge. You know, every statement by every scientist everywhere could be concluded with the phrase, as far as we know. It's always as far as we know, based on the current evidence, to the best of our knowledge. The question is how you come to that knowledge. Is it by revelation and tradition? Is it by evidence and reason? Is it by experiment? Is it by challenging what you thought you knew? We always know things only to the best of our knowledge, and so we shouldn't assume that we know everything. However, I would like to refrain from saying that there are things we will never know. See, that crosses the line, I think, between humility and superstition. Because there are people who said, we'll never know how people come to be, how they are. And then we found genetics and discovered the mechanism for evolution. Or we'll never know how big the universe is, and we found ways to explore that. There are things that we can find out. So I like to say, I don't know yet, instead of I don't know, for many questions. But I'm also willing to accept when the correct answer is I don't know. Frankly, when you get to the Big Bang and the few moments before the Big Bang, I don't know what happened before that point. And since I'm not a physicist, I don't know much of what happened after that point either. There are people that know, thank goodness, but I don't know. I can live with I don't know. And most importantly, I don't know is a true answer. If you say God, if you say Zeus, if you say nothing, those are all guesses. But I don't know is true. Even more important, though, for the question of inspiration, is how much we do know. Religion spends a lot of time, traditional supernatural religion, spends a lot of time telling you what you can't do, what you can't know. A humanistic religion spends time celebrating what you can do, what you can know, what we do know, what we have done, what we have accomplished. That's inspirational. It should never cross the line to chutzpah. We have to keep that model of humility involved. But at the same time, we shouldn't be so humble as to miss the wonderful achievements that we as people have achieved.
I'm somewhat fascinated by the issue of guilt. And in Breaking Away, you mentioned the issue being tied to the loneliness of being apart. But I wondered what you would think of the issue that of a tradition of cousins, of parents, grandparents, and holding on to what you don't believe, and the power that comes out of the guilt of being an individual in that sense.
Right. Well, you can ask the question, where does guilt come from? What is the evolutionary advantage of guilt? Why did we evolve this feeling of guilt? You'd think it'd be very disadvantageous. It minimizes our desire to innovate, our desire to explore, our desire to strike out on our own, which you'd think would be good things. Why guilt? It creates community cohesiveness. It's a break on changing the norms of the group. And remember, genetics is about group survival. It's not just about individual survival on an island somewhere. You need someone else to make more of you. That's the plan for genetics. So I think guilt has its origins in that desire for community cohesiveness to minimize your desire to strike out and change things. But the problem is, in a world where we're not only concerned about genetic survival, we do sometimes have feelings of guilt if we've changed what we've received. Our parents would be proud to know that they had succeeded in conveying the guilt they were trying to convey. And you know, sometimes Jewish people claim that they have the monopoly on guilt, but Catholic people tell them, no. There is plenty of ethnic guilt to go around. Because it's, again, that if you can't argue them rationally to do what you want, then you try to manipulate them emotionally to do what you want. So if I can't convince you to continue to observe this particular ritual or say these prayers, then I'll guilt you into doing it. I can't argue you into it. I haven't convinced you, but maybe I can find other means to get you to do what I want. And that becomes internalized. So even after the parent is long gone, we still have that feeling, well, I know they would want me to do this. And you may continue in that direction. The challenge is to find the right balance between respecting your past and living your own life. If I lived the life my parents wanted me to live, it wouldn't be my life. But if I lived a life indifferent to what they wanted, I would have disowned them, and I don't want to do that. I have the right to make my own choices. I take their input, but I don't have to reject them. You sometimes have wedding couples with this dynamic, where the parents say, well, you have to do this, you have to invite this person, you have to have this at the reception. And one of the partners will say, you can't tell me what I have to do. That's the high school response. And one of the other partners has the more mature response, which is, thanks for your input. Maybe they have a good idea, and you'll take the input and you'll respond to it. And maybe you don't agree to go their direction. Even if they say you have to, your response is, thanks for the input. I'll take it under advisement. I'll make my own choice. I think that's the healthy response to guilt, not the rejectionist get lost response, but to understand that it was an attempt to influence your behavior in a certain way, and you can accept or reject it, but you don't have to be burdened by the choice one way or the other.
Adam, I'm curious about when you were talking about different spiritual experiences, natural spiritual experiences, and you talked about the ones that come from nature, and you also talked about the ones that come from being involved politically or socially in a realm of different areas. Do you see a qualitative difference between those, or could you discern a difference in the spiritual experience, or are they pretty much the same along the whole
Well,
gamut?
I haven't come up with a scale. So I'm not going to rate, a nature experience is a 7 and a political rally is a 3. And that, I don't know that there's a way to rate it in that way. And for different people, it's going to respond differently. You know, the irony is even medications respond differently to different people because every human body is different. Well, how much more so is that going to be the case with these kind of experiences where one person is more nature-oriented, one person is more music-oriented, one person is more interpersonal connection-oriented? One of the great insights of the 1980s was this idea of multiple intelligences, that different people have different ways of being smart. Some people are number smart. Some people are word smart. Some people are nature smart, animal smart, spatially smart. You know, you can have a PhD in English literature who can't pack a suitcase or load suitcases into a trunk because their brain works differently. Well, again, the same is true in finding these experiences, different strokes for different folks. And I wouldn't presume to rate one as more than the other or deeper than the other. Everyone's going to experience it differently.
I'm curious about the word humanistic. As I know it has a lot of baggage, and how that word got chosen as opposed to human to describe this philosophy to which we all ascribe in one form or another.
Interesting question. Why humanistic? Well, in theory, an ism is a belief system or a cultural system. It depends on the usage. So humanism is not just being human, it's believing in human beings, in their potential, in their success, in their knowledge, in their power to have a positive impact on their own life and the lives of other people, on their environment, and so on. Of course, also their power to have a negative impact on their life, lives of other people, and their environment. That's also a corollary to a humanist philosophy. We do have meaningful power. Depends how we use it. Originally, humanism, if you look back to the Renaissance, was exploring human knowledge and experience in all of its variety. It was portraiture, not of the saints or of the Bible, but of real live people then and now. It was perspective in art, that it wasn't just a flat image, it was how it appears to you and how you see distance and relative size. That was the origins of humanism. It was dignifying the human being. As it developed in the 18th and 19th centuries, it became a philosophic system that emphasized more of this secular approach to life. Now, there are religious humanists who do believe in a supernatural realm, but who still believe that that supernatural realm gives power and authority and importance to human beings. And there are even some who are, it's odd to say, religious secular humanists, who are organized in religious communities like a humanistic Jewish congregation and ethical culture society. They're not supernatural, but they're organized on religious grounds, and they still have a humanistic approach to life that celebrates human beings and their power. The question of why not just call it human is that religion is human too. And so in some ways, to differentiate ourselves from the traditional, or to not claim that we are the true humans or the highest version of being human, as opposed to everybody else who's on a lesser plane, we've chosen a different term. I object to, I mean, there's an organization out there called the Brights. This was started by Richard Dawkins. And the claim is, of course, that the Bright has a naturalistic worldview, that there's only nature out in the world, no supernatural. But if you call yourself a Bright, by implication, anyone who is not a Bright is a dim. Or a dull, or burnt out, or whatever. It's obviously a superiority label. And I think humanistic is not claiming that one is superior to the other, and which would be the claim if we said, well, we are human philosophy. Well, there's a variety of philosophies. We are not the only way to do it.
Speaking of definitions, I loved your presentation, but every time I ask someone about spirituality, I get a different definition of what it means. And I've come to the conclusion that it's a word that perhaps we shouldn't use, and I'd love to have a substitute for it. Do you have any suggestions?
Suggestions for a substitute. Well, I've often used the phrase meaningful experience or an experience of meaning, and that could apply to a religious context or a secular context. I think it's one of those cases where I'm willing to be somewhat flexible on how people are using the term. That if for one person their spirituality is through institutional religion and revelation, for someone else their spiritual experience is through yoga and meditation, for someone else their spiritual experience is through cleaning a river and community service work. It's hard and exhausting but exhilarating at the same time. I'm not going to tell them they can't use that word. I might just ask them, what do you mean by that word? It means more conversation with people. But after all, that's important too.
My question is, we all want to be part of the big human family, and like another questioner, you know, raised, he said, sometimes people feel non-accepting if we're different. And my question is, what is the latest on how secularism is spreading around the world?
Well, it's a whole other presentation's worth of an apostasy or a heresy. So its global spread is limited by legal possibilities. In fact, the United Nations puts out an annual report on religious persecution that included persecution of non-theists in its listing of where people are being persecuted and why. In America, it's a complicated phenomenon because some organizations are growing very quickly, but in different measures. So the American Humanist Association, I think, is the largest by numbers. It has about 20,000 members. They have 100,000 likes on Facebook. Now, there's a clear disparity between the number of people who are willing to like them for free on Facebook and the number who are willing to sign up to join an organization with even minimal amounts of money invested. But that may be normal for activism and initiatives. People will sympathize with an issue but may not always put money behind it. They'll put other energies behind it. In America, what's been exciting people in the secular movement is the discovery of a new category, or not new category, but a growing category in demographics. It's what people call the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S. The nuns are people who, when asked, what is your religion, they say none, or no preference. The question, of course, is what do they actually think? And when you ask them deeper questions about God, about miracles, about prayer, then it's a more complicated answer. So even if the no religion population is something like 15 or 20% and higher among younger people, nevertheless, they don't all identify as secular or non-theistic. Many of them are, again, that freelance spiritual seeker, spiritual, not religious. If you ask them, what's your religion, they would say no religion. But if you ask them, do you have supernatural spiritual experiences, they would say yes. Well, they might not be candidates for our secular movement. Or some would argue not yet. Maybe they're evolving in that direction. After all, we do believe in evolution, even psychological. I mean, it's certainly an exciting time compared to 20, 30 years ago. But sometimes we forget that a century ago, American life might actually have been more secular than it is now, at least in the Jewish community. People are complaining because the affiliation rate of Jews joining synagogues or congregations is down to 45%. It was at 50% for a while. They forget that in the 1920s and 30s, it was 30%. There was a very active secular and humanist movement in this country in the 1920s. A lot of big thinkers, well-known journalists, public figures, would self-identify as humanists. And then things changed in the Cold War in the 1950s. So it goes through ebbs and flows. We're never as low as we thought we were, and we may not be as high now as we think we are.
One of my heroes is Sam Harris, and he recently wrote an essay that was very anti-Muslim. How do you advise your congregation to be open-minded when it's so logical to agree with a prejudice like that?
Well, one of the challenges is the line between prejudice and analysis. That is, if you say that a particular religious tradition has done X, that may be historical fact. In the Hebrew Bible, for example, in the book of Deuteronomy, it describes wiping out all of the Canaanites, lest they lead you astray with their idolatry. So you kill them preventively so you don't worship idols. I mean, it's awful. The one consolation is it never happened. That is, it was written by later generations saying, I wish we had done this. But still, the expression of intent is there. Now, does that mean that all Jews today have genocidal impulses? No. But it's part of that history and tradition. It happened. So when it comes to Muslim approaches to unbelievers, to heretics, to forced conversions, there are episodes and figures and thought and rhetoric and passages in the Quran that speak to that impulse. And there are others that are more tolerant and more accepting of diversity. There are Muslim people that you can meet I remember one of the announcements before the program was some kind of peace and justice coalition. I'm sure there are Muslim members of that that one could meet who are not going to take out their sword and demand you convert or die at the peace and justice meeting. The question becomes, how does one analyze the tradition as a whole? And I think one has to be honest that there are problematic elements in Islamic tradition, as there are problematic elements in Jewish and Christian traditions too. You know, the Inquisition was not just a song and dance number by Mel Brooks in his movies. And the Crusades were very, very, very problematic. But so too was the invasion of Spain under the Almohads in the 11th century, where they put the Quran on the point of their sword. And they said, pick one or the other. Take the Quran and convert or die. That was it. Now, that wasn't the dominant Muslim approach, but it was a Muslim approach. And even under the general consensus in Muslim civilization, Christians and Jews had to live in a subordinate status. They weren't allowed to build their synagogues too high. They couldn't ring their church bells too loud. Sometimes they had to wear discriminatory clothing or follow discriminatory behavior depending on the local area. And some areas were better than others. Iran was worse. Egypt was better in different times and places. Not to be too commercial, but we did actually run a conference on Jews in the Muslim world and produced a book out of it. If you're interested in that history of Jewish relations to Muslims and also what the potential is today for dealing with those problematic passages. In the end, the Muslim world needs to learn to do what the Jewish and Christian worlds learn to do, which is to not believe everything in the book, or to find ways to interpret it that are less violent. So if I read the Canaanites passage, I'm not inspired to kill Canaanites. And Christians who read parts of the Bible that they object to will find ways to live with it. Either they explicitly disagree with it, or they find ways to interpret it that works for them, but they're not going out stoning people and killing people in the way they used to, which was at the time thought to be Christianity. Islam needs to find a way to do this as well, and many Muslims are. The challenge is that some are not. And the question is whether you tar Islam or you tar Islamists, people who are hell-bent on imposing Islamic law on the world. That's different. That's a totalitarian ideology. But Islam as a religious conception can live in a Western context, accepting democratic rights, accepting women's rights even. It has to change to do that. But I would say, again, just like the atheist who claims that, well, the only true Christianity is fundamentalism, they shouldn't say the only true Islam is Islamism. There should be varieties of Islam. What we wish for the Muslim world is, and I have to say this very carefully, we wish for them the joy of sects, S-E-C-T-S. We want them to experience the challenges and the joys of a variety of denominations of Islam, some more liberal, some more traditionalist, but if they have that diversity internally, they will learn to accept diversity externally as well.
We have time for one more question. Go ahead.
There's been a lot of attention paid to the new pope, and one of the things he said, which made an impression, was, who am I to judge? Do you think that he's truly making a difference with that kind of individualistic question, or it's sort of PR?
Well, you could ask that old question, is the Pope Catholic? That is, has he changed any doctrines of the Church? Not yet. Now, I say not yet with the hope that maybe some of them will. Perhaps women could become priests, contraception not be outlawed, Catholic hospitals could serve people to the best of their medical ability instead of imposing dogma on medical treatment. He's done a better job on some issues. Certainly his rhetoric is better, and I'll take better rhetoric to start. But in the end, we are known by our deeds and not just by our words. So if the Pope really wants to change the Church will have to change. It's not only going to be language. One of the dilemmas is that so much of the Church has been traditionalized with John Paul II and the Pope previous to the current one, who put their traditionalist allies in positions of power all throughout the Church. And so it's going to be very tough to make the changes that the Church needs. I mean, I'm not really invested in the changes in the Catholic Church. It doesn't change my life one way or the other. But for the sake of, again, harmony and for human betterment, I think that movement on the contraception issue and movement on the medical care issue would be good for humanity and good for people having better relations with family, friends, neighbors, and living better and longer lives. With those that kind of progress, I think the world could be better. It will take real changes on the ground and not just words to change that.
Thank you, Adam, very much for coming.
Thank you.